Hello, this is Nancy Pippin with the Pantograph for Friday, September 6th, 2019. Looks like we're going to have a partly sunny day with a high of 80, low of 56, and it's going to be another great one. We see from the front page here that the NFL kickoffs started last night, and the Bears-Packers opened its 100th year. We'll talk a little about that on page B1 in sports. On the front page, we have a picture of two gentlemen. One is Dan Swanland from Bloomington. He is a worker at the Sonic Americas Drive-In over on Greenbrier in Normal. And he's busy sweeping up debris around the parking lot, and he's guided by a job facilitator, Mr. Gary Ferguson, with Mark First of Normal, which is an organization in the area. And this took place on August 30th. Swanland, that's the gentleman we talked about first, who has intellectual disabilities, has worked at the drive-in for several years and now works 3 days a week. So that's a big step here. Let's read about that first. Mark First Staff Longevity assists clients and community. Job satisfaction supersedes low pay. This article is by Paul Swish, and it begins, Dan Swanland doesn't care that his job facilitator at Mark First won a state award this year. But what matters to Swanland, who has an intellectual disability, is that he likes working with Gary Ferguson, who was named Illinois Direct Support Professional of the Year by the American Network of Community Options and Resources. He's one of my favorites, Swanland, age 30, of Bloomington said, as he and Ferguson took a break from Swanland's part-time job, keeping the patio tables, menu boards, and parking lot and lawn clean at Sonic Americas Drive-In in Normal. Sarah Spradu, 27, of Normal, who has an intellectual disability and lives in a Mark First group home, also enjoys receiving support from Mark First's DSPs. They take me out somewhere and help me with my laundry, she says. I like them because they're nice to me. They help me get a job, she says, of her part-time cleaning with the women's locker room at Bloomington Normal YMCA in Bloomington. Spradu spoke at Mark First in Normal, sitting across the table from Jason Paisley, her DSP of the Year in 2017, and Brenda Smith, DSP of the Year in 2018. The Normal-based agency provides support to people with disabilities. More impressive than the awards, however, is the longevity. Ferguson, 58, has been a direct support professional at Mark First for 28 years. Paisley, 45, has been a direct support person there for 19 years, and Smith, who is age 72 herself, has been a support person for 21 years, including the past 6 full time since she retired from her other job. Mark First, which has 110 direct support professionals who work full or part time, has 10 direct support persons. And we're moving on to page 2 here to continue the story. They have 10 support persons who have been there for at least 15 years. The longevity is noteworthy in a profession that nationwide has an average annual turnover of 45%. The work that they do is invaluable and hard, said Becky Burnham, Mark First Vice President of Residential and Quality Assurance. Support personnel help with personal care, cooking, cleaning, projects and with transportation to and from appointments and activities such as nature walks, exercise at the Advocate Bromine Health Center, and Friends First at Second Presbyterian Church. Brennan said, in addition, support personnel help some people like Swanland and Spradu to find and keep jobs, she said. Spradu learns about social skills, computer skills, and daily living skills, Brennan said. All of the people we assist have an intellectual disability, and some also have some physical disabilities, which can take a toll, Brennan said. The compensation doesn't match the work. The national average wage for a support person is $9.50 to $10 an hour, Brennan said. At Mark First, we start support personnel at $11. In the fiscal year, we come together and the people learn social skills and daily living skills. All of the people we assist have some type of disability. In the fiscal year that ended June 30th, we talked about the wage of $11 an hour. In the fiscal year that ended June 30th, Mark First had a turnover of support personnel of 19.3%. This was according to Chief Operating Officer Greg Chadwick. Even with the lower turnover rate, Mark First still has a support personnel vacancy rate of like 43%. Chadwick said, Mark First fills the gap by asking staff to work overtime and by contracting with agencies to provide certified nursing assistance, Chadwick said. Several Mark First support persons said they don't stick with their jobs because of the money. They grow as individuals, Ferguson said, of the people he helps. That makes me feel I was making a difference in their lives, despite the low wage. The population grows on you, Smith said. You develop relationships with them. You want to be there for them. The people I support become friends and family, Paisley said. It's very taxing and tiring when you go home. It's important to have someone at home to help you unwind, Paisley said. I have a team at home and a team here. But the good times are great, he continued. I was there when Sarah got her job. She hugged everybody. Smith and Paisley each make about $14 an hour. Smith said she can survive because she's retired from another job and also receives Social Security. I'm in a relationship where the other person makes a lot more than me. Ferguson, who makes $17.71 an hour, said he works overtime in Mark First group homes. I do it to have a living wage and to get to know the people, not just at their work, but at their home, Ferguson said. Chadwick said 85% of the money for support personnel comes from the state and the rest from the McLean County Health Department grants and fundraising. Illinois' minimum wage of $8.25 an hour will increase to $9.25 an hour on January 1st, $10 on July 1st, 2020, then each year until it reaches $15 in 2025. The agency is not against an increase in the minimum wage, Chadwick said. We want people to be paid a wage so they can live in the community. But to keep support personnel, they must be paid more than the minimum wage, and the state didn't allocate more money for support personnel, Chadwick said. By 2025, without more money from the state, the minimum wage will be higher than the starting pay for support personnel at Mark First. Our position is the work of support personnel is difficult and requires extraordinary skills, and the people who do that work should be paid higher than the minimum wage, Chadwick said. Meanwhile, Brennan appreciates the longevity of Mark First's support personnel. Having staff with that longevity is crucial to making people successful, Brennan said. When people can give back to the community, it makes everyone better, she said. When people are more active citizens, it improves the community. And this again was presented by Paul Swish, who can be reached at 309-820-3275 or follow him on Twitter at Paige Swish, SWIECH. And we'll go back now to our other news on the front page. And that is regarding Dorian. Carolinas feel the wrath of Dorian's sideswipe. And this is the hurricane we've been hearing about, my goodness, for almost a week. Let's go ahead and find out. It's blamed for 4 U.S. deaths, and Outer Banks could be in the path, and as we know, it now is. Hurricane Dorian sideswiped the Carolinas with shrieking winds, tornadoes, and sideways rain on Thursday as it closed in for a possible direct hit on the dangerously exposed Outer Banks. At least 4 deaths in the southeast were blamed on the storm. Twisters spun off by Dorian peeled away roofs and flipped trailers. More than 250,000 homes and businesses were left without power as the hurricane pushed north along the coastline, its winds weakening only to 105 miles per hour by evening. Trees and power lines littered flooded streets in Charleston's historic downtown. Gusts topping 80 miles per hour hit some areas. The damage from the same storm that mauled the Bahamas was mercifully light in many parts of South Carolina and Georgia as well, and by mid-afternoon, many of the 1.5 million who had been forced to evacuate in 3 states were already returning. Still, forecasters warn that Dorian could run straight over North Carolina's Outer Banks, the thin line of islands that sticks out from the U.S. coast. This article continues on A2, and we find that the article continues on A5. The article continues that it's kind of like a boxer's chin. Late Thursday or early Friday, it's going to hit the north hard. Virginia is also in harm's way, and a round of evacuations was ordered there. We have a long night ahead of us. Everyone needs to stay in a safe place and off the roads until the storm passes, said North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper. After leaving at least 30 people dead when it slammed the Bahamas with 185-mile-per-hour winds, Dorian swept past Florida at a relatively safe distance, grazed Georgia, then hugged the South Carolina-North Carolina coastline. I think we're in for a great big mess, said a 61-year-old Leslie Lanier, who decided to stay behind and boarded up her home and bookstore on Ocracoke Island on the Outer Banks, making sure to move volumes 5 to 6 feet off the ground. The National Hurricane Center forecast as much as 15 inches of rain for coastal Carolinas, with flash flooding likely. In Charleston, a historic port city of handsome antebellum homes on a peninsula that is prone to flooding even from ordinary storms, Dorian toppled some 150 trees, swamped roads, and brought down power lines, officials said, but the flooding and wind weren't nearly as bad as feared. And that's a major improvement. Dorian apparently spawned at least one tornado in North Myrtle Beach, that's in South Carolina, damaging several homes, and another twister touched down in the beach town of Emerald Isle, North Carolina, mangling and overturning several homes in a jumble of sheet metal. No immediate injuries were reported. In coastal Wilmington, North Carolina, just above the South Carolina line, heavy rain fell horizontally. Trees bent in the winds and traffic lights swayed as the hurricane drew near. The four deaths attributed to the storm took place in Florida and North Carolina. All of them involved men who died in falls or by electrocution while trimming trees, putting up storm shutters, or otherwise getting ready for the hurricane. At 7 p.m. Central Daylight Time, Dorian was centered about 30 miles south of Cape Fear, North Carolina, near the state's border with South Carolina. The Category 2 storm had maximum sustained winds of 100 miles per hour and was moving northeast at 10 miles per hour. As it closed in on the south, on the eastern seaboard, Navy ships were ordered to ride out the storm at sea, and military aircraft were moved inland. More than 700 airline flights scheduled for Thursday and Friday were canceled, and hundreds of shelter animals were airlifted from coastal South Carolina to Delaware. Tybee Island, Georgia, population 3,000, came through the storm without flooding. If the worst that comes out of this is people blame others for calling evacuations, and that's wonderful. Mayor Jason Bluderman said by midday Thursday, coastal residents in Georgia and some in South Carolina were all ready to go home. Still, South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster warned of new dangers ahead. Don't be surprised if there was water in your home and might have animals. Seriously consider snakes. You don't know what might be in there, so please be very careful as people return. That was from Governor Henry McMaster's in South Carolina. Not something I want to think about, a snake in my house. Well, the poor Bahamas. Bahamas Relief and the Bahamas Searching and Rescue Operations and an international humanitarian effort to help Dorian's victims picked up speed with emergency officials fanning out across the stricken areas and tracking down people who were missing or in distress. Crews began clearing streets and setting up distribution centers for food and water. That concludes our article on Dorian, but as I'm sure you've been hearing, there is still much more to come and much more support needed, and you'll hear about that in the news ahead on, you know, television and other radio sources. So let's go back to page one and see what else we have going on there. We heard about here in our community a way to support people and be a part of the community in a very positive way through being a professional support person. And the work that's been havoced through Dorian. And there are two other articles. We could continue with a forgiveness program that this is in the national news. Report loan forgiveness program full of rejection. We'll do that one first, and you may or may not have heard about it. And then we're going to talk about a teacher here locally honored to be a finalist and Illinois Teacher of the Year. That's quite an accomplishment. We'll end our front page with that note. Okay, so if many of you have student loans or know people with student loans, it says the vast majority of applications for student loan forgiveness programs are still being rejected. You know, they had, even after Congress set aside $700 million to temporarily expand it, according to a federal report. The Government Accountability Office said Thursday that the Education Department has created a, quote, confusing and inefficient process that would cause borrowers to miss out on the program. It urged the agency to simplify the application process. Congress approved the temporary funding last year after finding that only 1% of applicants for the Public Service Forgiveness Loan met the narrow eligibility rules, often because they had certain types of federal loans. Let's go on to page 2, and we learn that those kinds of loans weren't covered by the 2007 program. The funding was intended to expand the program to borrowers who were otherwise eligible but had other types of loan of federal student loans. But out of the more than 54,000 applications for the temporary funding, only 661 were approved as of May of 2019, according to the report. In total, borrowers received about $27 million in loan erasures out of that $700 million pool allotted by Congress. Most rejections were tied to a single eligibility rule that the department added but was not explicitly ordered by Congress. In order to qualify for the new funding, the agency said borrowers must have previously applied for the original loan forgiveness. Now, be clear on this. The Government Accounting Office found that the rule wasn't made clear to the borrowers. So of the 53,000 who were rejected, 71% of those were denied because the borrower had not applied for the original program. Now it continues. The report said the department has made only limited efforts to contact borrowers who could be eligible for the temporary funding, which was ordered by Congress when it approved the money. A department website on the original program does not include information on the expansion. The report found, and most loan servicers do not offer information on their websites. In other words, if you went to the person that you had your loan and checked their website, they would not have told people that they could be a part of this loan forgiveness process. House Democrats blasted the Department of Education over the report's findings, saying it is failing to follow orders from Congress. The House committee that oversees the Education Department says it will hold a hearing on this later this month. The report says that the department is failing to competently put the expanded program in place. This was according to Representative Scott, a Democrat from Virginia. He is the chairman of the House Education and Labor Committee, a situation he says is just mystifying and really unacceptable. Signed into law in 2007, the original program promised to erase federal student loans for certain public workers after they make 10 years of payments. It's meant to help college graduates who pursue jobs that often paid almost a modest salary. We're not talking big salaries, but serve a greater good. Careers like teaching, the military, or working with a nonprofit. But after the first round of borrowers became eligible to apply for forgiveness in 2017, only 1% of applicants were approved. Many students had made payments of 10-year payments only to find out it didn't have the right type of loan. Congress stepped in last year to provide that $700 million to expand the loan program to all types of loans until that pool of money runs out. And a group of Democrats proposed a bill this year that would make the expansion permanent. A letter responding to the government the General Accounting Office, Ms. Diane Ayers-Jones, the Principal Deputy Undersecretary of Education, said that when the program was created, it was clear then that relatively few borrowers would benefit from the program. But Jones wrote that her agency agreed with the government office's recommendations and remains committed to improving the customer experience for students, parents, and borrowers. So that, as I said, is the second half of our national news. So we've covered about Dorian in the national news and then about this loan program, which if you know someone that's in that type of service position with student loans, they would be very interested in this. And now we will go back to our front page with our final article, which is a very wonderful story about a young woman who's being put up as Teacher of the Year. It's a Bloomington Junior High School teacher honored to be a finalist. She's among 10 running in Illinois for Teacher of the Year. Helen Brandon, a sixth grade math and science teacher at Bloomington Junior High School, has been named a finalist for the Illinois Teacher of the Year program. "I am just completely humbled and honored," she said. "Teaching is what I love to do, so to be honored for doing something that you love feels pretty incredible." She is one of 10 finalists with the winner named on October 19th at a banquet in Normal. Other finalists are from schools in Palatine, Elmhurst, Olney, Northlake, Matson, Evanston, Rockton, Belleville, and Springfield. Brandon said she is thankful to work in a supportive district surrounded by welcoming students and guardians, and thankful that she can be the educator I want to be. As teachers, we work so hard because we love it, and we love our kids, and we love our community that we get to work in, she said, adding, "Being honored for her work is like icing on the cake." The winner will represent Illinois in the Council of Chief State School Officers National Program for Teacher of the Year. The program is overseen by the Illinois State Board of Education, which said the finalists include educators with a variety of backgrounds, ranging from an Air Force pilot to a teacher who hands out free instruments to students in the hallway to inspire a passion for music. Finalists are selected by a committee of administrators, teachers, educational service personnel, student support personnel, and past Illinois Teachers of the Year. The final selection is made by the state superintendent. Being a teacher means being a leader, a creative thinker, a problem solver, a caregiver, an advocate, and a bridge between the students and their future, said State Superintendent Carmen Ayala. Susan Converse was the 2019 Illinois Teacher of the Year. She is a special education teacher at Edwardsville High School. And so we wish the best for Ms. Helen Brandon, our Bloomington Junior High School teacher, as she enters this competition or this award season. And we'll look forward to hearing more about what happens on October 19th. So this kind of concludes our first half hour. And we're going to take a short break, and we'll return with the second half hour of the Pantograph for September the 6th, 2019. So please stay tuned.